Thank you very much for attending my presentation today, which will focus on what matters most to adults with spinal cord injury when it comes to quality of life and health outcomes measurements. This is the first dissertation study that I've completed, so I very much appreciate your feedback on this. This study has the findings of 20 in-depth interviews conducted with adults in the United Kingdom and in the United States. So this is what I plan to cover today. First, I'll have an introduction during which I explain the rationale for the study, and I will also review some key definitions that I'll reference throughout the presentation. I will then briefly review the literature, and then I will mention the study objectives. That will be followed by a discussion of the methodology, an exploration of the findings, and then I will review the strengths and weaknesses of the study, and I will conclude with a discussion of implications for policy and future research. But first, we ask, why study spinal cord injury? Well, spinal cord injury is a dramatic, life-changing pathology with very serious lifelong implications for the sufferer. We know that there are about approximately 300,000 individuals with spinal cord injury in the United States and about 40,000 in the United Kingdom. In both countries, approximately 90% of the cases were acquired through trauma. So that means road traffic accidents, falls, sports injury, gunshot wounds. The remaining were acquired through either diseases or other medical and surgical complications. Spinal cord patients typically require long-term and evolving care. So this means that the care comes from a team of professionals bringing very different skills at very different stages of the care process. For example, specialist rehabilitation, wheelchair provision, and social and community integration. So the team needs to share data about a patient's circumstances. They need to be able to communicate accurately and efficiently in order to approach a patient's care holistically. So that means physical, mental, and social health. We also know that the impact of a spinal cord injury will depend on the patient's lifestyle preferences. For example, whilst a football player may be absolutely devastated by a career-ending injury, a computer programmer may be able to come to terms with the injury sooner and get on with life. So all these aspects of spinal cord injury indicate that individual perceptions of health-related quality of life and subjective well-being are important in rehabilitation medicine. So two individuals with identical pathologies may have very different perceptions of their situation. In the next set of slides, I will be reviewing the key definitions that I referenced throughout the presentation. And typically, definitions vary by discipline, but for the purposes of this presentation, I have included definitions that are relevant to the field of health services research. So first, quality of life. Quality of life is an all-encompassing concept that refers to a person's physical, psychological, social, spiritual, and economic well-being. In the literature, there are variations in terms of how many domains it has. Here I'm providing the one that has 8 core domains, so physical well-being, material well-being, social inclusion, emotional well-being, rights, interpersonal relations, personal development, and self-determination. Health-related quality of life is a subset of quality of life, and it measures functioning and well-being in the physical, mental, and social domains of health. And it includes physical functioning, role functioning. It includes emotional well-being, for example, depressive symptoms, anxiety, anger, positive effect, pain, energy, and general health perceptions. When we look at subjective well-being, this refers to appraisals of life that include but go beyond health. And there are 3 subtypes of subjective well-being according to the Dolan model, which is also embraced by the National Academy of Science. We have evaluative well-being, which elicits an overall appraisal of one's life. We have experienced well-being, which measures emotional status and mood over a short period of time. And then we have eudaimonic well-being, which looks at perceived purpose in life and fulfillment. Next, let's have a look at how these 3 concepts were defined and measured in the spinal cord injured population. So quality of life conceptualization and measurement in this population. Some of the studies that I've come across incorporate previous conceptual models about quality of life, but many have a problematic atheoretical approach to quality of life. That means that in some of the studies I've seen, the researchers came up with their own definitions of quality of life and what they thought constituted quality of life, completely disregarding previous conceptual work and even theories about the inter-individual differences in this particular population. I've also seen misuse of surveys on this population, age and condition inappropriate. For example, a survey that was designed for adults age 65 and older administered to spinal cord injured adults as young as 18, or condition inappropriate surveys that were designed for cancer patients administered to adults with spinal cord injury. So this shows a failure to understand the content and context of life with spinal cord injury, which of course poses problems for content validity when these surveys are applied. And this may explain some of the contradictory findings in the literature. So the same survey applied to the same population. In some studies, they find, for example, that there is a negative relationship between level of injury and perceived quality of life. In others, they find absolutely no relationship. And there have also been inconsistent findings in terms of predictors of quality of life, such as age and gender. If we look at the health-related quality of life conceptualization and measurement in this population, the issues remain the same. And in fact, there are some researchers who argue that the health-related quality of life, as we defined it earlier, may not adequately represent disability. So the model that I presented earlier aligns closer with the medical model where disability is perceived as a problem that needs to be fixed by medical interventions. But if we look at fields such as disability studies, they embrace the social model where disability is defined and driven by social barriers, social discrimination, and environmental barriers as well. Some of the surveys that have been used are the short form 36. So this is a generic health-related quality of life survey and was applied this was the most frequently used actually on this particular population. And the problem is that some of the items in the survey don't apply to people who use wheelchairs. So they have questions about walking and climbing stairs. And so what some researchers have done was to add, delete, or modify items, but without measuring them psychometrically. Another survey used is the spinal cord independence measure, and this looks at the level of independent physical functioning in adults with spinal cord injury. This has been described as a targeted health-related quality of life survey, but some argue that it's actually too narrow in focus for it to be a health-related quality of life survey. And finally, the example that I have is the SCI Quality of Life 23 survey. This one was derived and applied in Sweden, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but the problem is that it seems that the researchers there wrote it in Swedish, tested its psychometric properties in Swedish, and then translated it in order to publish it in an English language journal. And so when I looked at this survey to see if I should maybe include it in my study, I saw some items that made me question the rigor of the process. And I'll give you two examples. One of the items was, I feel as I'm slowed down. Another one, how difficult is it not being able to hide oneself in a crowd? So I've decided, as they say, to give this survey a sort of wide berth. When we turn our attention to subjective well-being in conceptualization and measurement in this population, this concept, again, has not received a lot of attention. Several studies that I've looked at equate subjective well-being with quality of life, so they consider them equivalent. Others assume that the factors that influence subjective well-being remain the same throughout one's lifetime. Others assume that they change. The one model that I thought was interesting was the one proposed by Dishkers and says, subjective well-being in this population is a reaction to an evaluation of the match between one's achievements and one's expectations. I haven't come across any studies that define subjective well-being the way that I've presented it earlier. So overall, the literature review seems to suggest that there's been very little focus on individual priorities and expectations in this population, And that's because there hasn't been a lot of qualitative work done on these patients, so there certainly needs to be more qualitative research. So what then were the objectives of this study? Well, first, to describe how adults with spinal cord injury in the United States and in the United Kingdom perceive, define, and prioritize their quality of life. And the reason I've chosen these two countries for comparison is because the spinal injury patient journey through the system is very different. In the United Kingdom, emergency care, post-acute care, specialist rehabilitation, and even wheelchair provision are all free at the point of need. In the United States, with the exception of the VA, care tends to be fragmented and very much confined, defined by what somebody's insurance covers. So I thought it would be interesting to see perspectives on quality of life and care and rehabilitation from these two very different cultures. The second objective was to examine what types of health-related quality of life and subjective well-being surveys matter most to these adults. And third, to describe inter-individual variations in health-related quality of life and subjective well-being assessment in relation to their context of life. So now let's review the methodology. Participant recruitment. There were 20 participants in this study, 10 in the UK and 10 in the US. I have done purposive sampling to ensure that certain demographic and clinical characteristics were present, such as gender, age, etiology of injury, and also level of injury, paraplegia and quadriplegia. The inclusion criteria were adults aged 18 and older, male and female with spinal cord injury, full-time wheelchair users, and at least 1 year post-discharge. Exclusion criteria were inability to provide consent and inability to read and write in English. The recruitment took place through print advertisements, through patient advocacy groups in the United States, the Spinal Injury Association, the Backup Trust, a patient magazine called Forward, in the United Kingdom, the SIA, the Backup Trust, and Forward magazine. In the United States, it was the Paralyzed Veterans of America. And I've also done some recruitment online through spinal cord injury-specific forums such as A Paralyzed. Data collection. I conducted...
So do patients receive an incentive for participating?
Yes.
There's a whole lot of strategies you had to collect 30 people.
Yes, so they were offered $10 for participation, but only two of them accepted the pay. Mm-hmm. So, which I thought was very interesting because some of them seemed to really struggle financially, but they were just happy to sit down and talk about.
Yes.
Well, just as a follow-up, what she's saying, like, how many people actually said they were interested?
33 in both countries. And there were a couple who didn't qualify because they were part-time wheelchair users, and about seven or eight received a follow-up email with information about the study and what I was going to do in the study, and they never responded. So overall, I had 22, and I conducted two pilot interviews by phone, and then if I can just continue to clarify what happened. So I conducted two pilot interviews by phone in order to test the survey questions, one pilot in the UK, one in the US. And as a result of these interviews, I ended up making some structural changes to the way I phrased certain questions, the order of the questions, and I even added questions about things that I hadn't thought about before. So as a result of that, I didn't include these two in the final analysis. And after that, I conducted 20 in-depth semi-structured interviews, 10 in the US, 10 in the UK. And of these, 12 were conducted in person and 8 via Skype. Of the 12 that were conducted in person, 2 were in the US and 10 in the UK. I was in the UK in April conducting these interviews. And then the 8 via Skype were done only in the US. The geographic spread for this was pretty broad. So in the UK, participants came from the southeast, the southwest, the Midlands, the northeast, and Wales. And in the United States, they came from California, Texas, Florida, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, Wisconsin, and Alabama. So it was pretty broad. The interview lengths ranged between 80 minutes and 4 hours, and the interviews comprised two parts. In the first part, the interviewees were asked questions about life with spinal cord injury, quality of life, and rehabilitation. And in the second part, they were asked to review and rate 6 questionnaires. These questionnaires were selected based on the literature review in terms of which surveys were most widely used on this population, but also on a previous study that I conducted with regards to the overlap between health-related quality of life and subjective well-being. The sequence in which the questionnaires were presented was varied for each participant in order to control for order effect bias. So let's have a look at some of the examples of the questions from the interview guide. How did you come to need a wheelchair? How did you feel when you were told you were SCI injured? How would you define quality of life? What matters most with regards to your quality of life? Do you think that your medical provider is interested in knowing about aspects of quality of life that matter to you? Why not? When someone gives you medical advice, how important do you feel it is for them to know about other aspects of your life, such as those we have just discussed? Moving on to the analysis, the audio files were transcribed verbatim by the author, me, and using grounded theory, the content was coded independently by 2 different coders in Atlas TI. I was one of the coders. The other one was a person based in the UK with experience in spinal cord injury and qualitative analysis, and they did it for free, so it was a win-win situation. Coding occurred in 2 rounds. In round 1, we coded content from a random sample of 5 transcripts and calculated a kappa of 0.75. And after we reconciled the coding of the first round, we coded the remaining 15 transcripts with a kappa of 0.82. Generally, in the literature, a kappa of 0.80 is considered good. The codebook at the end comprised 108 content grounded codes. 76 codes were identified in the first 5 transcripts, and the remaining codes were identified in the next 11 transcripts. So this suggests, yes?
Sorry, what is grounded theory?
This means that when you read a verbatim transcription of an interview, you let the text tell you the meaning, so you don't start with preconceived ideas of what you should be looking for. So the fact that we found the entire sort of code book in the first 16 interviews suggests that the full range of content-grounded themes occurred in the first 16 interviews. So let's have a look at the findings. First, the clinical characteristics of the sample. Regarding chronological age, the 2 groups, US-UK, were pretty similar. So the median age in the US was 57, in the UK was 51. However, time since injury suggests that the UK group were a bit more experienced and they've had a longer period to adjust to their injury. Regarding level of injury, the 2 groups, I apologize for the misalignment, everything was okay earlier. The 2 groups were pretty similar, with the exception of incomplete quadriplegia, where I didn't have anybody with an incomplete quadriplegia in the UK group. And then the etiology shows the sort of diversity of sources of injury. This is a bit more nuanced than the standard report where they just, you know, studies differentiate between trauma and disease. But this is to show different lifestyles and the, you know, diverse ways in which people acquire injury, from, you know, playing rugby to diving. Road traffic accidents, both being in a car on a motorcycle and as a pedestrian, and then disease, spinal infarct, TB, and myelitis. A big surprise came from the asking participants about their number of weeks of post-acute rehabilitation. So in the U.S., the median was 14 weeks with a range of 2 weeks to 34. In the U.K., it was 40 with a range of 12 to 72.
How about the number of sessions? It could be the same number of sessions, but spread out over 14 weeks versus 40 weeks, just with longer intervals. So, do you know?
No, I didn't. It was whatever they mentioned. And that would have varied, because I had 4 participants who had been at the VA, so their care was very different from the person, for instance, who was dropped after 2 weeks because the insurance stopped paying. So, if I didn't go into that.
The reason I was just asking is for a lot of these neurologic conditions, there's big emphasis on the topic that they're one of the ones that you mentioned, which is the importance of team-based care.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they want to advertise what they're doing, they give credit if they saw a social worker or a dentist or this or that. But
right.
they might see them once in all the months.
Right.
And that's really different than what many of these people need, as you know,
yes.
which is ongoing
well,
access.
I'll give you an example. So I had two people. I had one person in each group with C2 injuries. The person, so that's a very high level of injury. Both of them were on ventilators. The one in the UK got the 72 weeks number of care, time of rehabilitation. The one in the US was 3.5 months. So that should, I suspect, paint the picture. Moving on to the demographic characteristics. So there were 5 women and 15 men in the entire sample. In the UK, I had a lot more men than women for some reason. 17 participants identified as white, 2 as African American or black, and 1 as Pacific Islander. In terms of education, we note that the US group were a bit more highly educated than the UK group. And in terms of employment, more people in the UK at the time of the interview were working full-time, and there were more retired people in the US group. And in terms of living circumstances, the groups were fairly similar. So what were the emerging themes? So there were 5 overarching themes. The first one, quality of life in the context of SCI. So this is where the participants talked about what quality of life meant to them, and how they would define it. And the remaining codes are about factors that affect quality of life. So I have medical care, functional adjustment, financial resources, and sociological context. And there were 23 sub-themes sort of supporting these 5 overarching themes on what constitutes quality of life in the aspect of, in the context of SCI and factors that affect quality of life. So let's take the first overarching theme. So this is where interviewees had difficulty providing a comprehensive definition of quality of life, but they did comment on aspects of quality of life that seemed to point at quality of life domains that were highlighted in previous conceptual work. So they talked about physical health, and this included the ability to conduct activities of daily living, such as personal hygiene, dressing, eating, continence, and instrumental activities of daily living, such as communication and mobility. They talked about mental health, and they talked about social functioning. And we know that these are, in fact, health-related quality of life as a subset of quality of life. But they also recounted the importance of intimate relationships, including sexual and reproductive function, material well-being, including housing security, the ability to acquire disability-specific items, services, and technology. They talked about rights, civil rights, and government support, and they talked about religious beliefs, but only participants in the U.S. group mentioned religious beliefs. And I have several quotes to support this overarching theme. The first one about the importance of medical care, and also about the importance of the changing the priority in domains. So as I get older, my quality of life and the quality of health are becoming more of an issue. But at the moment, it's more about keeping me socially active and my relationship with my wife and family and the quality of life in that respect. So health-related quality of life becomes more important as this person is aging, and this person has lived with spinal cord injury for about 30 years. Another quote shows how priorities change immediately after the injury, and then again a few years later. What matters to me varied a lot over the last 11 years. Actually, my first one was not being able to get up and do things, but eventually that passed on. And to tell you the truth, if I could only get one thing back without any issues, it would be my bowel care. So they're talking about a change from mobility to hygiene. Let's explore the medical care theme. And this one was a key factor affecting the participants' quality of life. Here they talked about their rehabilitation experience, both in positive and negative terms, about wheelchair provision, about primary care, and about family caregiving in the home. So positive rehabilitation experience, here they recounted about having access to good specialist care, access to physiotherapy and occupational therapy, regular follow-up post-discharge, and access to advice and support as needed. I should note that of the six U.S. participants who talked about positive rehabilitation experiences, four received their care from the VA. Negative rehabilitation experience. Here, they recounted stories about rude and impolite behavior by hospital staff, lack of patient education about treatment options, self-care, sexual education, pressure sore prevention. They also mentioned hospital-acquired complications and institutionalization issues, such as lack of privacy and strict routines. However, only the U.S. group, and in fact, more than half of the U.S. group, talked about insufficient length of rehabilitation. When they talked about wheelchair provision, so some of the positive comments had to do with receiving a comprehensive assessment, being measured, being assessed for pressure points, having their home assessed to see if they could operate the wheelchair in the home. They talked about the wheelchair being perceived as adequate for one's condition and needs. The UK group in particular talked about other aspects as well, such as the entitlement to multiple free wheelchairs through the wheelchair service and the access to work scheme, which is a government scheme that gives vouchers so that the people who want to return to work can buy wheelchair-adapted cars or wheelchair-adapted office furniture. Now, the negative experience with wheelchair provision, this is where the differences between the two countries were a bit more pronounced. So only the U.S. group talked about receiving no assessment at all for their wheelchair, receiving no information about the range of available wheelchairs, cushions, and accessories, and about the bureaucratic burden to secure a wheelchair, especially when dealing with Medicaid and Medicare and having to prove the medical necessity in order to receive a certain type of wheelchair. But participants in both countries talked about receiving little wheelchair training or maintenance, so that was also an issue in the U.K., and participants only in the UK talked about their caregiver needs not being considered when they were given a wheelchair, so being given a very heavy wheelchair that, you know, a wife or spouse would have to then push, and limited availability of outdoor wheelchairs. When it came to primary care experiences, interviewees in both countries talked about care coordination, the physician being proactive in facilitating access to specialists, follow-up with care and appointments, and the involvement of the patient in medication management. In talking about negative primary care experiences, both groups recounted having to deal with uncaring physicians, perceived general physician inexperience with spinal cord injury, but only the U.S. group talked about not having access to primary care because of lack of insurance and perceived ineffective medical care. And participants in the UK talked about difficulty in arranging home visits through their GP office. And finally, positive caregiving in a home. So half of the groups talked about this, and the running thread was the fact that the caregiver had received specialist training in terms of how to look after a spouse at home. And again, in the US, four out of the five had received care from the VA, and the VA had trained the caregiver. Let's look at functional... actually, I have a few quotes, sorry. With good quality care, you can then build... You have got the foundation blocks to build the rest of your life. So this is how somebody in the UK talked about the importance of good quality care. But next, I have a quote from someone in the UK who hadn't been consulted about their treatment options. In 1983, they cut my sphincter to my bladder. I hadn't a clue what that meant. They just did it when I was in hospital. It wasn't explained in terms of what might come further in life, what I might that I might just drain all the time. Looking back on it, I could go and slap them for doing that to me. And then another quote from the U.S., from the gentleman with the high neck injury who didn't feel that he received sufficient rehabilitation. I was in a hospital for about a month, and then I went to a rehabilitation center for 3.5 months. Then I came home. The reason why they sent me home is because the insurance stopped paying. All that they care about is money. When talking about functional adjustment, participants in all groups talked about the mental adjustment post-discharge. So here they recounted feelings of shock, anxiety, feeling sorry, helpless, in denial about the injury. They talked about fear of health complications, of institutionalization, uncertainty about marriage and having children, and also described coming to terms in terms of career change and not being able to walk again. Both both groups talked about the impact of the SCI on the physical and mental function. And here the most prominent issue was bladder and bowel management for both groups, followed by pain, mobility, spasticity, sitting tolerance, and lack of sensory ability. SCI-related complications, again, was an issue for both groups. They talked about pressure sores, persistent hypotension, chronic UTIs, and bowel obstruction. And when we talked about their SCI knowledge post-discharge, both groups talked about learning a lot through their lived experience after being discharged home. However, there was a marked difference in the two groups in terms of how they learned about spinal cord injury and basic care, both while in hospital and after discharge. 7 of the UK participants mentioned that they felt they received sufficient information about SCI and self-care, but 9 US participants said that they felt they received insufficient information upon discharge. And in fact, 6 of the 9 at the time of the interview reported that they had to resort to the internet to find out information about very basic health and rehabilitation, such as self-catheterization, self-care, transfer techniques, how to dress, how to transfer from bed to the wheelchair, cushions, wheelchair availability, etc. So this one stood out in terms of the different narratives. Mm-hmm. Both groups, again, talked about consequences of aging with spinal cord injury, pain, fatigue. Home adaptations were another important factor affecting functional adjustments. So structural adaptations at home to facilitate access, personal hygiene, transferring, cooking, working. Again, at the time of the interview, all UK participants said that their houses were adapted to meet their needs. 4 of the U.S. participants said that their homes were not adapted at all. Fatigue, both physical and mental, was an important factor, and then public infrastructure in terms of access to public transit and access to public buildings. The fourth theme, financial resources, here participants in both countries talked about positive financial status and negative financial status. So here they meant having sufficient money to support oneself and or family, for example, paying housing and utility bills, and having sufficient money to provide for one's health and rehabilitation needs, for example, getting the right wheelchairs, home adaptation, adaptive transportation, and assistive technologies. In terms of negative financial status, again, participants in both countries complained about the expensive disability products and services on the private market. They felt that some providers were out there to make money out of their need. But only participants in the U.S. group talked about having insufficient money to support oneself and or family. And only participants in the U.S. group talked about having no insurance, under insurance, insufficient money to provide for one's health and rehabilitation needs. And finally, the overarching theme of sociological context. Here, both groups talked about family and social attitudes to spinal cord injury. Here they described moral, financial, and logistical support by the family, friends being inclusive. But both groups lamented attitudes to disability, infantilizing of adults, biased media coverage, and predatory behavior by commercial providers. And finally, government policy. Half of the participants in the UK group talked about the importance of universal provision as a positive experience, and then 3 US participants were very critical about government policies towards disabled people and the differences between states. Now we're going to move off to the findings in the second part of the interview. So here the participants were asked to rate and review 6 surveys. And at the end of each survey, they were asked how important it was for their medical provider to know their answers to each of these surveys. And they could say it was vital, it was important, not important, or don't know. So I'm going to list the surveys from the worst rated to the top. So the worst was the short form 36, where only 6 participants said it was important. Hedonic well-being, and well, I'll review each of these in more detail, explaining what the surveys were. Hedonic well-being, satisfaction with life survey, eudaimonic subjective well-being, the spinal cord independence measure, which is a targeted measure specifically for this population, and the fatigue severity scale. Now, when it came to sort of trends in terms of marking these surveys as vital or important, All the participants who said any of these surveys were vital were people with incomplete injuries. And from my experience, these are people who tend to experience more pain than those with complete injuries. So I thought that was interesting. And then all the participants who marked any of these surveys important were people with higher injuries, so T4 and above, and all those who experienced quadriplegia. And there were no marked differences in terms of UK-US responses. So let's look at the first survey, the short form 36. So this is a generic health-related quality of life survey that has questions about physical, mental, and social functioning in the health domains of health. And the first question is, in general, would you say your health is excellent, very good, fair, poor? And when they reviewed this question, I probed them about whether or not when they were asked about health, they considered the spinal cord injury as part of that answer, and also whether physical or mental health mattered more to them. So the findings were that general health and SCI are perceived as separate by younger respondents. So only as people age with the injury, the issues associated with their spinal cord injury tend to become part of the broader health issue. The importance of physical health prevailed for U.S. participants, and half of U.K. interviewees considered physical and mental health equally important. This survey, if you remember what I mentioned earlier, also has questions that don't apply to people in wheelchairs about climbing stairs, running, walking, and these questions were found extremely offensive. In fact, I have two quotes. What a bloody stupid question. It's insulting in a way. I'm C4-5. So this C4-5 is a pretty high-level injury. Generally, people with C4-5 have no sensation from the chest down and very, very limited upper body function. Another quote, it's stupid. Why are you going to ask me if I can walk when I can't? I kind of was offended. The next survey up the scale was the hedonic well-being survey. 9 people found this important. And this assesses experienced well-being the day before the survey is administered. And questions include, yesterday, did you feel sad, happy, pain? There are 12 questions in total. And some recognize the usefulness of this in terms of helping their doctor understand their life circumstances, but noted that it would require very frequent administration to build a picture of their life. Others disagreed with regards to its usefulness. To me, the survey doesn't really tell you anything about the person or the circumstances. It doesn't reveal anything meaningful. How can someone be very happy, very enthusiastic, and yet be a little angry? You know, it just doesn't tell you anything. The next survey, satisfaction with life scale. This is a survey that has 5 statements about one's life, and people can rate them from strongly agree to strongly disagree. The conditions of my life are ideal. If I could change my life over, I wouldn't change anything. A few participants commented that it was too vague or broad to be helpful for their physician. This one I'm less thrilled about because when you talk about ideals, these very polar terms, ideal, excellent, I don't know how revealing they really are. But others did think that this was helpful. If GPs could have a summarized picture as to how you feel at that point, then that would help. Pretty important because these may lead to questions that help your doctor understand what you need at home. I do believe it's useful. Most of the satisfaction issue, especially with an injury like mine, is because something isn't accommodating you. When looking at the eudaimonic subjective well-being, this is where we're moving into the surveys that were marked vital by some of the participants. So 4 said vital, 7 said it was important. And this is a standalone question that asks, overall, to what extent do you feel that the things you do in your life are worthwhile? And they have a range from 0, not at all, to 10 completely. Half of respondents in both groups talked about this question's potential to instigate more clinical probing. They talked about this question being important as part of holistic care, so helping their physician get a sort of idea of their mental state. And when they talked about worthwhile things, both the U.S. and U.K. interviewees talked about family, work contributions to society, and pursuit of pleasures and creative interests. And I have a quote to support this. I think it's quite important. It could tell the GP if somebody was depressed or didn't like their life. I think your primary care physician should know this stuff. I think they should know how you feel about your life. How can they possibly make a diagnosis or even make any assumptions unless they know what's going on psychologically, physically, emotionally? Moving on to the spinal cord independence measure, participants were a bit more positive about it because they felt it was relevant to their life circumstances and their needs. And that's to be expected. This is a very targeted SCI survey that assesses their level of independent physical functioning. I think this was good. I think it's important to know what a person is capable of doing because that factors into quality of life, the potential for experiencing different problems. These are the things I can and can't do versus something more subjective like happiness. I think they need to know that. Other interviewees commented on the fact that this survey could communicate a lot of important information efficiently, thus leaving more time to discuss other issues during a visit with their physician. Trying to explain to somebody who only has 7 minutes of your time, you know, makes all the difference. There were others who were critical, though, of this survey. This seems to be differentiating between when you are out of the home and in the home. I don't think that's a meaningful distinction. I want my doctor to understand what I need to function, particularly as it relates to the wheelchair, whether I'm at home or not. And they're not asking any questions about how long do you sit in the wheelchair? Do you need to move to a different space to get pressure relief? Finally, the top-rated survey was the fatigue severity scale, and as they were highlighting the importance of this survey, participants described how fatigue featured in their lives. So they said that it was exacerbated by aging. Some talked about it as a symptom of serious problems such as bowel cancers. When they critiqued it, they did so because they felt it was unclear if it refers to mental or physical fatigue or both. And they thought that some answers elicited are not particularly informative for their physician. However, they did acknowledge the survey's potential to trigger further probing. Let's have a look at a few quotes. When I do get really physically fatigued, then I am more mentally fatigued as well. I won't be able to concentrate as well if I'm really, really tired physically. What makes you vulnerable to fatigue includes sitting tolerance and the environment in which a wheelchair is used. If you've got a manual wheelchair and you're pushing it in an area where the surfaces aren't great, that can tire you out. But you also get fatigue just from sitting in your wheelchair. You can get fatigue from pain. Another quote was a bit more critical about the usefulness of this survey. Saying that fatigue is disabling, what does that mean? Does that mean that you can't do the things at all? Does that mean that you just feel so discouraged by it that you don't even just want to try? These are just not specific enough questions. But as I said, some thought it had potential to trigger probing. It is important, and I wouldn't have even thought to bring it up. The word fatigue and trying to explain why I can't do more, you've got pain and fatigue makes the pain worse, and what you talk about is the pain. You don't talk about the fatigue making the pain worse. So the fatigue brings on the pain. A very important point, yet I wouldn't have walked into the doctor's office saying I get fatigue. It wouldn't have occurred to me. So these are the findings of the survey. Let's have a look at the strengths and the limitations. So one of the strengths is that it is a two-country sample. So we get perspectives from people who live in two very different cultures, with very different health systems, and we've seen the differences emerge when they talk about the length of rehabilitation, the way that wheelchair work were provided, financial circumstances, and also education about SCI and basic care and self-care. The study also has clinical relevance because the interview questions were posed with a view to eliciting information that would be difficult, that would be useful for medical providers, especially regarding the importance of holistic care, so thinking physical, mental, and social. And also the use of surveys to extract information efficiently and thus leaving more time to discuss other issues or probe based on the findings of the survey. The use of Skype to broaden geographic scope, and it's not just geographic scope because in using Skype, I felt that I had access to people who otherwise would have never agreed to meet with me in person. And this is applicable mostly for the U.S. sample, because as I said, four people who participated did not have their homes adapted at all, and they lived on their own. So one lady, her bathroom was on the second floor. She obviously didn't have access to it, so she was using the ground-level kitchen for her hygiene. And she thought that was, she actually described it as disgusting. and she wouldn't let anybody in the house to see that sort of indignity. So by talking to her on Skype, she had a lot of control in terms of how much I could see of her, so just the upper body, and how much I could see of her place. In another instance, again, a lady who was living on her own and her house wasn't adapted, she hadn't received support with self-catheterization. She had problems with using diapers because they irritated her skin. So every day she would just dress her upper body and, you know, not put anything in the lower body and just cover herself with a blanket because that made it easier for her to clean up after accidents. So again, she would have never invited me in her home for me to talk to her and see her in that state. So using Skype gave her more control over the situation, and if an accident happened, she could just switch off and we could resume later. In terms of limitations, the sample representativeness is something that's inherent in these sort of studies. Even though the geographic scope was broader, it's still questionable if this sample represents the patient populations in both countries. Now, looking at implications for policy and future research, this study reiterates the importance of individual priorities and expectations in designing care plans and long-term rehabilitation. So people with very similar pathologies can have very, very different reactions and attitudes and personal priorities, and they need to be included in the care process. We also should pay attention to the factors that affect quality of life, such as fatigue, home adaptations, wheelchair provision, the bureaucratic burden in the United States, and education about spinal cord injury. And the study draws attention to the need to use SCI-specific survey that extract clinically meaningful content. For people who have upper body mobility issues, filling out these surveys can be quite an effort, and so if they do, it needs to be worth their while. And also, if we are to ask physicians to include these as part of the care process, it needs to be worth their while. And to do so, we need to use SCI-specific surveys. With regards to implications for future research, the use of Skype and FaceTime in in-depth interviews could be explored further in terms of other patient populations. We need to examine how surveys can be incorporated in SCI and in long-term care. I read a lot about barriers such as physicians thinking that it takes more of their time, the information that's gained is just not worth it, quality of life is not needed in clinical care, we need to balance soft versus hard data, how do you interpret the scores? So more studies could be done, especially in the context of spinal cord injury care, to see what clinicians need in order to help them use these surveys. And finally, given the primacy of the fatigue severity scale, there should be further research on fatigue in this particular population and also on factors that make wheelchair users vulnerable to fatigue. So with that, I will take your questions. Yes.
First, I want to thank you for just a superb talk and for being so thoughtful about very complicated topics.
Thank you. Yes.
I was intrigued by your last point, which I agree with, that it's important to understand how providers would use survey data. But I think there's another important point here, which is I think we should also learn, if we're burdening the patients to do these surveys, especially serial ones, how can that help the patients?
Yes.
So it's not only do we need to study how the surveys will help the providers, but also
yes.
how they'll help the patients.
Well, the idea that I got from the interviewers. Yes, indeed, yes. Some of them were willing to complete these sort of surveys at home in preparation for their meetings. And really the barrier was that they felt that some of their physicians wouldn't really care about these, so why would they bother? So the sense is that if they felt the physician would care about it, then they would be willing to share that information. But I agree with, I have people on ventilators, so as I said, for some of these patients, it would be a great deal of effort to do so, so it really needs to be worth their while.
Yeah, so if, you know, especially if longitudinally they saw mm-hmm. how they were declining or improving,
mm-hmm.
it would help them maybe figure things out.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that you said too that we often have to fill out surveys in doctors' offices, and it looks like they don't pay any attention to it.
Yes.
And then you stop over time and say, forget it, I'm just wasting my time.
Yes.
Not even looking at it, so that can help. But You keep mentioning Skype, and you really didn't say what's the advantage of that over, I know it's visual, but over a telephone survey. So do you think that nonverbal cues is helping you as the interviewer? And the
it helps to, yes, it helps to see their facial expressions. And, well, there were a few instances where, you know, some people had these sort of spasticity attacks during interviews, so that was interesting to see how they recovered afterwards. So body language is helpful, especially when talking to patients about very difficult topics. But if I have to sacrifice some of that rich field data just to get access to people, then I would argue that that's a sacrifice. Yes.
First of all, that was really a wonderfully presented talk. It was really obviously very well prepared and organized and thoughtful. And, you know, it was really, I think we all learned a lot from this. And it's an important population to be paying attention to. I couldn't help but think throughout your talk about a patient who I took care of many years ago, early in the AIDS epidemic, who was a young man who had AIDS, and there was no particularly effective treatment at that point, and he died not too long after this particular point, where we gave him one of the newer drugs, and he developed transverse myelitis, which gave him paraplegia. And at some point, I don't know, maybe because I was working with him on AIDS at the time, I asked him to rate his quality of life on a scale from 1 to 10. And I thought it was going to be 1 or 2, but it was, as I recall, it was something like 7. And I was just shocked. I thought about it after, and I didn't criticize him for that, of course. I thought about that. He was a person who was really very well supported. We had a whole community who were around him, and that really seemed to matter and seemed to make a difference. And probably understanding the interaction of these different domains and can have a big impact on, I guess, the rate that a serious new problem would have with an individual. I don't know.
Yes.
It's very different from what you'd expect in, you know, in the...
Yeah, and that's another thing that I found in literature reviews, is the extent to which healthcare professionals impose their own view of life and you know, how they think about an issue as fully able-bodied on their patients. Yeah, that's another, yeah.
Well, also, you have that paper where you address overall quality of life mm-hmm. on a bunch of items, mm-hmm. but Barbara Vickery did a study where she had overall quality of life, and what we found in that is that it pretty much defined mental health mostly. It was a really good indicator of mental health. So if mental health is good, you know, you could see how you could rate it highly, even if physical health was not so good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi, we have never met before. My name is Dawson Wood. I'm a fourth year neurosurgery resident, so thank you very much for doing this work. It's very important for us. But within your patients doing all of these surveys, you know, and having differing opinions, do you have like one form in which you collected all of the questions that patients found most pertinent that we could potentially use?
Yes, yeah, in fact, and I also have their own rating, so they actually rated. They did the SF-36, so I have that data as well, mm-hmm. And the scores for each. So I'm happy to give some of that information if it's helpful.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Just in terms of creating a survey that's most accurate, could potentially pull the most useful things from each of those.
Yes. Well, my third dissertation study will be about fatigability. So I'm working on developing an index that measures not just the fact that somebody's fatigued, but what is it that makes them fatigued? So it'd be more clinically relevant than others. So I'm quite happy to chat with you about that. Okay, and I apologize again for the misalignment. It worked well before, so I don't know what happened. Yeah.
It's going to be hard to refer to it, but when you were talking about the first set of results, you were talking on first were health-related quality of life and uh-huh. then other things, but a couple of things like sexual, whatever you call it, relations or
yes.
something, that's often considered social health.
Okay.
And there was another one that was like religious beliefs, but sometimes religiosity is considered also part of, depending on who you are, not as often, but sometimes that's considered health-related problem there too.
Okay. Yeah, I just, well, the fact that they talk about sexual and reproductive function with so much concern, as opposed to just relationship with friends and being able to meet with friends, I thought it would be good to refine that and mention it separately in this population. Well, thank you very much for attending. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.